Today's guest is a revered educator, accomplished author, a wife of decades, a mother of three adult sons, and in many ways, her life looks like quite the success. However, as a little one, she was told by her mother that if her brother had lived, she would never have been born. A stunning comment, to say the least, from a mother to her young daughter. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'd like to welcome today's guest, Dr. Barbara Jaffe, who is author of When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. Dr. Jaffe, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you heard me just share with our listeners a comment that was made to you by your mom when you were a little one. And in the very beginning of When Will I Be Good Enough, you described Jeffrey, your brother, who died at two, as a little boy whom I never knew and who was not talked about, but became the most important person in my life. Explain how that could be.
Well, early on, it was certainly subliminal. I didn't really know him other than the photos because we weren't allowed to talk about him. But as I grew, I realized there was an entity that was coming between my mother and I. And when I would ask about him, she just didn't want to talk about him. But she never recovered, as, I mean, I can't imagine any parent fully recovering, but being able to move on. She was not able to move on at all, and there was a part of her heart that was closed. So I realized I tried so hard to do anything to make her happy and provide that entity that Jeffrey wants, which, of course, is an impossibility. So that's what I meant by the fact that he was so important to me because of his presence in our house, in our relationship between my mother and I.
When you say in your, when you indicate in the title of your book, When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. What do you mean by a replacement child? Literally replacing Jeffrey, or what do you mean by that? Or is that a real term?
Yeah. It actually is a real term, and it was defined earlier on. I think the original replacement children were considered those who were born after the Holocaust, recreating new families. There's been research. There's been a recent book put out by Dr. Brenner and Silverman on the replacement children and their unconscious scripts. There actually is even a replacement child syndrome. But the definition, the literal definition, is a child that was born purposely to replace a child that had passed away. So maybe the family had their family completed, they didn't want any more children, but something tragic happened and they decided to have another to replace that child.
You know, it's such a heartbreaking thing to think about, whether it's the parent who's lost the child or the child who was born, quote unquote, as the replacement. You described a scene in your book, which was almost breathtaking, where your mother had just buried her two-year-old son who died suddenly, Jeffrey, and the doctor came by the house. She was in tears. He slapped her. And what did he say to her?
He said, "Get over it. Move on. You have a child." I have an older brother who's almost 7 years older than I. And he says, "Have another," as if, you know, you can replace a piece of pottery that broke and get another one. And she would often refer to that as her therapy. And it was so tragic and so sad. And I was so empathic about that as I grew up, especially becoming a mother myself. That's just horrible. And that's how she dealt with it. And I think from that time on, she just swallowed everything. And I can't blame her. It's very sad. I have tremendous compassion for that.
Well, and for any parent who loses a child, but then to have someone who you look to as an authority figure, if you will, your doctor, tell you, get over it, have another one. You're right. It's like going to the store and buying another piece of pottery or another apple. It's just, you know, that one's gone. Oh, well, let's just get you a replacement. It's just extraordinary.
Right. And especially in our family, too, we didn't talk about, well, they didn't talk about feelings. I hadn't been born yet. And her parents and were, you know, they said, have another child. And so just a few months later, she got pregnant with me. And of course, she wasn't ready. There were no groups at that time for support, for parental loss, the kinds of group and support that there are today. And even if there were, I don't know whether they would have, you know, been part of that. But nevertheless, it was very tragic how this doctor handled it.
And how did your father and your brother respond to the loss of Jeffrey?
Well, it's very interesting. My brother, who was, like I said, almost 7 when I was born, so he was about 5 and a half when Jeffrey passed away. My brother has absolutely no memories of Jeffrey. None.
Interesting.
So that's a very interesting situation, especially at a traumatic time where I assume he probably went to stay with my parents' grandparents, you know, with the grandparents or something that provided some kind of change in his schedule. So he doesn't remember anything. My father, on the other hand, was very willing to talk about it if I asked questions. He showed us some of the last reels of footage that he took at the Christmas before Jeffrey died, and he showed us Jeffrey's baby book. So he was more willing to talk about it.
You know, it's. I'm thinking about your brother, 5 and a half, and having no memory of his little brother. It certainly sounds like you're right. It was a trauma. That loss was traumatizing for him as well.
Yes.
It would be absolutely traumatizing for the whole family.
Sure, you're right.
And so when you came into the picture, did you, as far as you know, was there the experience of joy that you were there? I mean, were you looked at as this wonderful new life, Barbara, or were you the Jeffrey replacement?
No, I do believe that I was looked at this wonderful new life, Barbara, especially being a girl. My parents, my mother especially, wanted a daughter, so I think that was great in some ways, although I think she was partial to males, which is kind of ironic. But so I know that I was loved and wanted. But as I said, it became a very complicated relationship as I grew up, because I wanted to please her so much, and I felt that I always fell short. So her interaction with my brother Stephen was very different throughout our entire lives than her reaction with me. Some of it was the fact, maybe personality-wise, maybe she connected more with my brother. I think she expected far less from him than she did from me throughout my life. So the dynamics were very different, but I have no doubt that I was loved and wanted, and I felt that. But I think the difference was my father provided unconditional love, and my mother at times was conditional love.
You say that it took you your lifetime, your entire life, I quote you, for me to realize that nothing I did could actually fix what was broken, nor could I create my rightful place in a family whose blueprint had already been designed. What was the blueprint?
The blueprint was a family of 4, 2 little boys, and no trauma and no illness. And I think that was the blueprint, and it was not what was expected. I mean, we all have, I call them Kodak moments, Kodak images of how we want our lives to be and expect them to be, and then, of course, things change. And I think that was the blueprint that had to be redone.
And in the redoing of it, you felt so much the burden of trying to be the child who would make your mom happy.
I did, and I had a lot of the personality traits of somebody who was a perfectionist, who wanted to people-please. It was kind of the perfect storm. I do believe that, you know, we come into this world with certain genetics and personality traits, and I think for me that was what was a challenge with my mother, who was a very strong personality, and I just at many times would crumple. And as I said, what affected me the most throughout my life was my self-esteem, my self-worth, and my self-confidence. And again, I do not place blame. I always feel the statute of limitations of blaming parents runs out at 18. We all have our own lives, and I use this as a way to look at the pieces of myself that I felt were broken and that I needed to put back together.
I think there are a lot of parents who would love to see a t-shirt that says the statute of limitation runs out on blaming your parents when you hit 18. I think you could make a fortune.
I think we're all responsible for our own actions and behaviors.
The depth and the breadth of the experiences of the emotional cloak, if you will, that you carried as a child truly comes out in your writing. I was stunned and immediately drawn into what it must have been like for you growing up when you describe yourself as having a permanent assignment as your dead brother's understudy. And you say that you began to realize that there were parts of you that were missing. Were those parts self-esteem, self-confidence? What were the parts that were missing?
Yes, the self-esteem, self-confidence, self-worth. I think on the outside looking in, I don't think anyone would have realized that. But I always felt that I was having to swim upstream like a salmon or in quicksand. I wasn't depressed, but it was a feeling that I had to work twice as hard for everything that seemed a lot less effort put through from other people. So, maybe that was just a perception, but it was my perception, and it was something that I had to deal with. I was very outgoing, but very shy at the same time, and I was very hard on myself. So those are the areas in which I grew up feeling that I knew I needed to examine.
When you say that you had a parent who loved conditionally and at times fearfully, I think we get the conditional love piece of it, but what was the fearful part of mothers loving you?
My mother had a way of cutting me off when she was upset with me, and she would close her door, slam her door, her bedroom door, and stay in her bedroom, and for a long time. And to this day, whenever I see a closed door, I just melt. I remember working somewhere where when the boss was upset, he would go in and slam his door and be in his office. And it just viscerally brought me back to my childhood, how powerful that was to be cut off. And I think that's the difference. And over the years, I felt that that was normal. Oftentimes we're raised in a way that we think, well, that's just the way it is. But I realized that was conditional, because if I was good, the door was open. If I said something or did something that was wrong, the door was closed. And I kind of used that as a parallel to her. The door was closed. Her heart was cut off at those times.
Such a powerful lesson.
It is a powerful lesson. And when I became a mother, it was something that was a blueprint for myself. I thought, gosh, I could very easily fall into that, but I was cognizant of the fact that even if my children weren't doing something I wanted them to do, I made it a point to make sure that they knew I loved them no matter what. That, you know, that was a lesson for me. I took the lead from my father and from my husband, who was very good with that.
The times that your mom would say or do things that left you feeling not good enough, do you think in part they were a reflection of her blaming herself, of her not feeling good enough, particularly in light of the loss of Jeffrey?
I think you're absolutely right. I think as a child, though, of course, I couldn't have known that. But
right.
As an adult, I look back and say, she was wounded, she was broken, and such compassion I have for her, and such love I've always had for her, and I know that she had for me. And you're absolutely right, she just could not come through that. She was not able to talk about it and deal with it and find a way to go on from that. So yes, absolutely.
You know, it speaks so much to the importance of allowing oneself to grieve when there are losses, and to the need for others not to determine how and when and if one should grieve.
Yes, and everybody has their own timetable. Related to that, when I was upset about something, my mother, I think, became very upset for me, but she didn't have the tools in which to just listen and say, you know, we'll work it out together, it'll be okay. Instead, she would say things like, I know other parents have said, like, you know, you think you have problems, or it could always be worse, or you don't have any right to feel that way. Those were the comments that I would get, and I grew up feeling that I didn't have a right to feel that way. And yes, it's true, people have something worse off, so then I shouldn't feel the way I feel. That should was a very big word in our household, should, shouldn't. And I've worked very hard at realizing that, yes, people might have it worse, but we're all entitled to the feelings that we have.
Absolutely. And you're right. That word should is just such a powerful word in the lives of many people. And it really shortens their view very often of what life is or could be about.
Yes.
You talk about an eating disorder. Can you give us a sense of, in your view, how that eating disorder developed for you?
Well, initially I was a chubby child, a chunky preteen, and I loved food. Family food was very important to us. And my mother said to me, you know, you should really watch it, which were code words for you're getting fat and you should, you know, not eat as much. And I, as I said, I was probably 10, 11, 12 at the time. And my father was kind of chunky. My brother wasn't. My mother wasn't really. But and so I never thought about it. But that became the beginning of wanting not only to please her, but also wanting to maybe look a little thinner compared to the skinny little girlfriends that I had. So I stopped eating as much. And people said, you know, you look good. And my mother was happy. And then I thought, well, I could do this. I could keep doing this. If I look good now, I'll just look better. And it got out of control. And again, it's probably my personality, the qualities of the perfectionist, of not having the boundaries, of just taking it to extremes. And so probably within a year, less than a year, I became anorexic at a time when I didn't really know what that was. My mother didn't really know what that was. They didn't have the information and the support groups and help. She brought me to her gynecologist, and her gynecologist virtually said, you are killing your mother. You have to eat. So that wasn't really helpful. And so I...
to put it mildly.
I'm sorry?
To put it mildly, that wasn't really helpful.
Yes. And so it became a lifelong battle for eating and then not eating, and then my mother pleading for me to eat, and then I would eat, then I would gain weight, and then she would kind of look at me, and to the point that she didn't have to say anything anymore. And when I was stressed or when I was upset, I just naturally stopped eating. So it has been a lifelong issue for me that I have worked with some body dysmorphia, and knowing that, you know, I just take it one day at a time, but it was always a battle. The last many years, whenever my mother would see me, she would say, you're too thin, you're not eating. It was just a constant thing, the food and everything.
So either you were too thin or you were not thin enough.
Right. Again, when will I be good enough? It's all part of that syndrome.
Right.
For me, and it manifested itself in an eating disorder.
Dr. Barbara Jaffe, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue with the conversation about When Will I Be Good Enough?, a publication created by Dr. Barbara Jaffe, subtitle, A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. We'll be right back. Dr. Jaffe, you describe as you were growing up the attitude that mother had with respect to you as her daughter, leaving the house and sort of going off to live your own life. And her view was that daughters don't leave their mothers. I wonder if underneath it, it was that replacement children don't leave their mothers.
You know, that's a very good point. I think you're right about that as well. I grew up in a very close-knit family in terms of my grandmother and her sisters. She had five sisters, all lived in San Francisco, and lived a couple of them lived next door to each other. My grandparents, fourth generation San Francisco, so it's very, nobody seemed to ever leave. And I really was the only one in the family to actually leave. Well, the only one in the immediate family to go to college. And I intuitively knew that I wanted to go away and that I needed to go away. But I did. It was a cardinal sin that I left San Francisco, but that I left my mother.
Talk about what it was like for you when you did leave. What were your college experiences like?
They were amazing. It was one of the best experiences of my life. It was the first time I was on my own, and I felt like a child in a candy factory. I just couldn't get enough of it wasn't like I went wild and did things that other people might do just, you know, to experiment or rebel. It was just that I loved education, and I loved the social aspect of it. And I loved the reading and the learning, and it was the first time I was able to make decisions on my own, and that was glorious, and it was something that I was not aware of. I remember I was never allowed to own a pair of jeans growing up. Keep in mind, San Francisco, Levi Strauss, it's, you know, the capital of the jeans. I was never able to own a pair. So what did I do when I went to college? I bought jeans in every possible formation. I bought overalls. I bought shorts. I bought jean purses, jean jackets. And when I came home, my mother was appalled.
I'm sure.
Perhaps that was my rebellion. I don't know. But it was such an amazing sense of freedom that I could carve out my own world and my own life.
Would you say that it was a beginning of your ability to look within for self-affirming realities about who you were, the truth of who you were?
Absolutely. Okay. And I became on a mission to search for that. It was at a time where in the 70s, there, you know, ESP and EST and all of the different groups in which to learn more about yourself, past life regressions, psychic issues, not to mention all the academic, sociology, psychology, the wonderful. So it was a time that I was searching. And at the same time, I must say, I was very much tied to my mother and would call her almost every day from school. So that provides a bit of a perplexing dichotomy there. You know, on one hand, I'm so happy to be by myself. On one hand, I was totally aware of the fact that she missed me and I missed her and that I needed that connection.
A complex relationship, to be sure.
Yes.
You decided that you were going to teach and you were going to be the world's best teacher. Talk about some of those experiences.
Well, I think for a teacher, if you really want to be the best teacher in the world, I think it's to the advantage of the student, because the teacher, me, did everything possible to make my students like me and to make them feel that it was the best class they've ever had. So that's pretty good from the student's point of view. From my point of view, it's like the brooms in Fantasia. They keep multiplying, and you're working harder and harder. And at some point, you say to yourself, I say to myself, gosh, this is very draining. But I loved what I did, because I just retired a couple months ago. I loved what I did, and I actually was able to say, you know, I don't have to be the best teacher anymore. I'm passionate about what I teach. I can be good enough. And that's what I came to the conclusion. So some of that energy that was overextended, I was able to kind of rein back in and still be an effective and wonderful professor, but yet, you know, saving some of that energy for myself. But initially, I needed to be the best in everything.
That was part of what motivated you, I think, to pursue a doctorate.
Yes, I think for myself, because I didn't need it professionally, but I needed to prove to myself that I could do this, what I called the final frontier. Actually, if I could rewind the tape, I don't believe in regrets because we all do what we need to do for ourselves, but I would have loved to have been a medical doctor, but I was very tentative about math. I had a couple negative experiences with math teachers. I had a very hard time with math. It was also, I was told at a time, you know, girls didn't go into sciences. Girls didn't need to go to math, do math, and certainly girls shouldn't be doctors. And so I remember going away to college and saying what kind of profession I would have, and I said, well, I wanted to be a doctor. Well, who's going to take care of your kids, my mother would say. Well, I want to be a nurse. Well, you don't want to clean bedpans. So that was her definition. She just, one after another, eliminated it all. And she actually said, if you go away to college, you need to study at the med library or the law library so you can meet a lawyer or a doctor. Not once that I could be the doctor or the lawyer. So it was very interesting how I ended up with a limited choice, but yet on my own, I had enough confidence to choose what I wanted to do. And then later on, I said, I need to do this for myself. At a time financially and in my family, like, why would we have another person go to school? The three boys were in college. Why would I go? But I did.
You did, and you survived it.
I survived it, and everybody else survived it, too.
Imagine that.
I know, right?
There's so many sort of like moments that you describe and you share what was said to you about various events, and they're almost kind of jaw-dropping. And I turn to the conversation you had with a colleague, and you wanted to be, I think, the dean, and you wanted to advocate for the faculty. And what was his response to you?
Yes, that was another wonderful lesson for me. I wanted, I had several years in administration. After I had my doctorate, I thought I would love to, become a dean, vice president, president of a college. I thought that would be a great trajectory because I had been in teaching and I knew all the different areas, and I would be so helpful to the faculty and students. So he said, why do you want to be a dean? And I said, because I want to provide support for the faculty so they can do the best they can do in the classroom. And he goes, what do they need support for? And I just had to pick up my jaw, as you said. I just could not believe it. And I needed to remind myself that I used to say, someone doesn't mean what they say. He can't mean that. And then I've come to the conclusion, and as I've gotten older, yes, people tell you who they are. They do mean what they say. Or I used to say, well, someone's nice deep down. And I'm thinking, I'm a nice person, and you don't have to go deep down. So apparently if someone is not acting nice, then maybe they're not nice. And those were the things that I've learned from that.
I think about people in relationships and how valuable it would be if we all recognize that what people say to us is, in fact, maybe what we should listen to.
Exactly. Instead of rewriting our scripts, so interpreting what we think they meant.
Or what we want to think they meant.
Even more. So true.
You describe an aha moment during your professional career that included a stapler. One would not connect a stapler to an aha moment, so help us understand.
I was an administrator, and a wonderful faculty member who I like so much saw me from across the quad outside on campus and came running over to me. And in my mind, I created this idea that she was going to say what a great job I'm doing as an administrator. And she said hello, and she asked me to reimburse her for a $10 stapler. And it was a moment of clarity for me that I realized, I don't know if this is the right direction for my passions and energies to have to replace. I wanted to just give her the money and call it a day, and I'm thinking, no, I need to listen to this. this is how I am viewed, perhaps, by some people, rather than my expertise in helping pedagogy and, you know, helping teachers strengthen their skills or working with students. So, again, these sometimes little moments are really the moments that change the trajectory of our lives.
I cannot underscore enough the importance of listening to what you hear. It can be so powerful, and so many of us don't gift ourselves with that time and that skill and that ability.
Yes, it's true. It does take practice, but it's so worthwhile.
Again, speaking to some of the extraordinary things that were said to you, that are actually said often to people, to children and adults, and let me just share with the listeners what was said to you by your Spanish teacher, and you can take it from there. How about that?
Okay.
You were in high school in a Spanish class, and you raised your hand, and your Spanish teacher asked you if you were going to ask another stupid question.
Oh, yes, I wasn't laughing then, but I just melted. There are some stronger souls than I who probably would have said, I will show you, and will continue to ask those questions. But I was very tentative, as I stated, lacking the confidence, and what I did instead was just fold up. And not only was he my Spanish teacher, but he was my homeroom teacher.
Oh, no.
So I saw him twice a day, and it was just so uncomfortable. And I did stop asking questions, and my grade suffered. And again, aha moment that I kept with me, because when I became a teacher, and a student would raise his hand and say, I'm sorry to ask this question, it's probably stupid or it's not important. And I said, every question you have is important. There is no such thing as a stupid question. I actually took the negatives and turned them into the positives in my own teaching. So for that was an amazing lesson.
And I would just like to point out to those listening that it really is important to think about what it is you say to people, to children and adults. And I'll just leave it at that. Words have power that can last and does last often long after you've actually uttered them.
So true. And we never know which of those words that someone is going to hang on to.
You describe yourself as now having come to a place where you can love yourself. In fact, you say self-love peacefully. How does self-love and peacefulness come together? What's the connection?
I think to be peaceful, to have serenity, is a gift that I never knew existed, because there were often times when I'd go through the day where I loved myself, but I was always anxious and kind of on alert. And if I learned to take my ego out of things and not have to be right about everything and just accept people on their own terms. And again, as you said, not wanting them to be something that I imagine, again, taking away expectations, I have a level of peace and serenity that I've not had before.
And
related to the idea of expectations, I have another little adage that I had heard, that expectations are planned disappointments. So I do not have a lot of expectations of other people. For myself, yes. Again, I've learned to cut those back, too, because I'm not striving for perfection these days. But I do not have the level of expectation that I have of others.
Say a little bit more about that, about expectations of others.
I think when we have ideals and expect people to act a certain way, to respond a certain way, we are setting ourselves up for disappointment. We can't know what they're thinking or what they're going to say. I'll give an example. I've been married to my husband, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, for a long time, over 4 decades. And there was a period of time, not too long ago, then I would act a certain way or say something, but that's not what I meant, because I fully expected him to know exactly what I meant. And I had this epiphany too. I said, how can he know what I'm thinking? I am the only one who knows what I'm thinking. If I want him to do something, then I need to tell him what I want him to do. It was very clear. But growing up in my family of origin, that's why I think I was very good with languages. We read between the lines. We did not say how we felt. You know, the idea like, what's the matter? Nothing's the matter. Well, we certainly learned that something was the matter, the way the tone, what was not said. My husband was not that way. So I needed to say, this is how I'm feeling, or I'm feeling sad today, or I can't expect him to know. And that simple expectation, taking that away, has changed everything.
It's extraordinary how what may often feel like little changes or tiny tweaks in a relationship can mean so much in terms of the overall health of that relationship.
Yes. An example would be I'm having a lunch date with a friend who's notoriously late. I do not expect her to be on time. So I have to make the decision, do I want to have lunch with her? If I do, then I will take a book with me. And I will spend the extra 15, 30 minutes and know that when she comes, she will come. So I have choices. I don't have to put the whole thing on her because I already know what's going to happen.
Would you ever say to her, it troubles me to have to wait for you?
I would. I could say, you know, but she calls along the way to let me know. She is not one of the people that, you know, it's just comes in and say, well, you know me. She says, I am going to be a few minutes late, but it's kind of consistent. But if there's a problem, then, you know, I've said, gosh, I was so hungry, I started to order, you know, something like that. But I can make the choice as to how I act, respond to that, instead of putting all of the expectations on her. Those little things really help me and my peacefulness and serenity.
And help your awareness, your positive awareness of yourself, I would think, and your own power to make choices in your own life.
That's right. Absolutely true.
We are talking, I am speaking with Dr. Barbara Jaffe, author of When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. We'll be taking a break and be back in just a moment. So please stay right where you are. Dr. Jaffe, in the one of the final chapters of When Will I Be Good Enough, which actually is chapter 9, Open Doors, you provide a template for folks to really sort out where they are in their own lives and what they can do for themselves. Can we talk about some of those questions that you invite the readers to respond to?
Sure, absolutely. Those were questions that I would ask myself. Those were questions that I used in terms of walking through the different challenges that I had. So these are all tried and true. I have on page 189, rewriting our life scripts that do not serve us. So one question I say, if you feel as if you aren't as good a parent as, and then fill in the blank, what does she or he do that you do not do? And then I say, after you've listed what that person does, ask yourself this question. By doing this, in what ways do you think you would become a better parent? And I ask that about if you feel you aren't a good enough employee, or if you feel that you aren't as good a family member, or spouse, partner. And then a very important activity I've done over the years is, what are 10 activities that you do well? So much in our society is always focused on negativity, what we don't do well, and what we do well. And why do you feel you do them well? An example would be patience. I have a tremendous amount of patience. And that is a quality that, you know, is not everybody has. Some of the things I do well could be I make a great banana bread. Little things. It doesn't have to be monumental things. I make a great cup of coffee. And that becomes a pattern in our lives if we can do that on a regular basis.
You also suggest that folks learn how to only give advice if asked, and not to if not asked. Why is that important?
Yes. I came to that realization when I decided that I would only give advice when asked. Why would I tell somebody what I think they should do when they haven't given that information, asked me for that information? So I came to the understanding that I wasn't asked a lot. So therefore, I must have been giving advice when it wasn't necessarily asked for. So now, especially with my children, because they're adults, when they ask my opinion and they want my advice, I'll say, do you really want me to tell you what I think? And they'll say yes, and then I will. Otherwise, they'll say something. I give them the ability to make their own decisions. And of course, you know, it's different with a child, you know, a little, you know, don't go into the street and, you know, those kinds of things. But as an adult, not to be told what to do, not to give advice unless asked, is great, because most of the, I'll just say I have had a zero success rate in changing another person in my lifetime. So I am not going to change them by giving them advice and telling them what to do if it's not asked. And then most of us know how hard it is to change ourselves, so impossible to change another person. And that has been a wonderful, helpful lesson for me to add another layer of serenity in my life.
It certainly has you doing a lot less work, doesn't it?
It sure does. More energy to focus on myself and what I would like.
Which is not a bad thing at all.
No, it isn't.
I just want to shift the conversation a bit. You have been an educator for certainly a bit. Do you have a worry or a concern about the way in which we think about education today? Is there something you would change about our educational system?
It's a great question. I think that no matter how advanced technology gets, and certainly it's been a godsend for so many things in terms of the computers and the internet, obviously, I think that we can never lose sight of that human contact. More and more classes are online. It's cost effective, and certainly I understand in terms of logistics, the internet is fantastic. Online courses for people who physically cannot get to a campus. But never to lose of that human contact. There are so many times where I'd be out in the hall and people would be sitting next to each other and they were totally disconnected. I always say it's the most connected, disconnected generation, or the most disconnected, or the most connected, disconnected, because we're so in tune to everybody and so connected, but yet we are isolated in so many ways. So I think that that connection between teacher, between student, between other students is something that I always tried to facilitate in my classroom, where they could put down their phones and actually talk to each other.
You know, it really is true that in so many ways we are extraordinarily connected, but in that connection, how many times do we go places and see entire families sitting together and they're on their various devices? They're not together at all.
Exactly. That's right. So I think that, and that's just not in education, as you said, that's socially, that's everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's a cautionary tale to work on.
Is there a value in your view to homeschooling?
A lot of the students that I've had over the course of many years at the college, not a lot, some were homeschooled, and they were always amazing students. And I think if a family is comfortable with that and the children want to do that and the parents want to give of their time and it works, I think it's great, provided the child also has activities outside the home and they're socialized. But I've seen many wonderful results of that.
Okay. Let me go back to your book now. Thank you for those observations. You suggested folks gently take what is theirs without waiting to be offered or given. That doesn't sound like a very ladylike approach, or the one that you were taught growing up.
No, it's true. It's not what I was taught growing up. What I was taught growing up was to wait for someone to give you what you need or want, which one can wait forever. And what you want is not as important as what someone else needs and wants. So I have learned in that area called self-care. For a long time, I thought that was selfish. But now I understand that in order to be able to give to others and have the energy to live a full life, we also have to first and foremost take care of ourselves, and kind of liken it to the metaphor when we're on an airplane and they talk about the oxygen mask that comes down. They tell us to put the oxygen mask on first and then to help somebody in need, a child or somebody else. And that makes a lot of sense. If we're not there for ourselves first, where else can we be? And so I have very slowly accepted what I need to do for myself. And in the beginning, it kind of ruffles feathers of people around who are not used to you acting that way. And then slowly they accept, okay. I give the example, I took myself away on a couple-day writing retreat so I could write a lot of the book and just be by myself. And in the beginning, my husband, you know, I could tell wasn't thrilled that I was doing that. And by the time I had done it so much, he'd say, have a wonderful time and I'll miss you. So it can happen. It's just a very slow. It's like once we own ourselves and what we need and want, then everybody else is eventually okay with it or not. But we have to first take care and nurture our souls, ourselves.
You shared a mini interaction between yourself and your mom as she was actually failing in health. And you said something to her, and her response was such that it really speaks to, well, let me say what you said to her, that you were sorry that you weren't the daughter that she wanted. And she
Yes.
said, we don't always get what we want.
Yes.
Which could throw somebody over the edge and then some. And so, you know, there are these moments when your mother has said to you extraordinarily hurtful things, and yet you are still able to acknowledge and honor the woman she was, the complexities of who she was, her joys, her successes, and perhaps those painful parts of her. How are you able to do that when somebody can say to you, well, we don't always get what we want?
You're right. That was devastating. And if I had heard that as a young child, it would have marked me in a way that I don't know, so profound. And I was very sad to have her say that to me. That was our last conversation in person before she died 2 weeks later. We both obviously didn't know that that was what was going to happen. But by then, I had come to terms with the fact that I was an amazing daughter. I was the best daughter I could ever be, and that I loved her regardless of the hurtful things that she could have said to me. I was very cognizant that I had those tools that I didn't have before. And so when she said that to me, I immediately heard an internal voice that said, I know she loves me, and I know that I have been the best daughter that I could be. And I was really able to come back. Sure, it hurt, but I was able to bounce back in a way. And I could not have done that without the internal work that I did and the understanding of my self-care and nurturing myself to be the friend and the mother that perhaps I wanted to be. I mean, that I wanted to have. But now I get to be the mother that I want to be.
The ability, again, to see your parent, to see any of our parents as whole human beings with their flaws and also with the things about them that that are helpful and useful and have impacted you in a positive way is really critical for the healing of so many.
Yes, it's very critical. And we can only do that when we take our ego out of the equation and become vulnerable enough to look at the areas that we ourselves need to work on. And that's where the transformation happens, and that's what I was hopeful when readers read my book and may not be a replacement child themselves, but can connect to those areas of vulnerability and to know that we can all have full and rewarding lives despite what people in our lives have said to us or done to us, that we can be internally successful.
That we don't have to hold on to some of the painful experiences that we've had.
Exactly. We need to let those go.
And when you talk about being a replacement child, that certainly could also include children who are adopted to replace other children or the lack of other children for whatever reason.
Absolutely. Blended families, as you said, adopted families, and also families where, sadly, a sibling is ill and require the attention of parents, where the healthy child might feel in some way that they have, you know, gotten less attention, understandably. But so much of that can be dealt with through conversation and communication, which wasn't the case in our family. But so much of these unforeseen situations can be really lightened by just the conversations between parents and children.
The final words that you would like to share with those who have lost a child, whether it's a tiny one or an adult child, is there anything that you would like to see them consider incorporating in their lives that may not be there already?
The communication. So if my mother had said to me, you know, we lost a child before you were born, we wanted you so much, it's still so very sad. I think about him all the time, but you are your unique person. We love Jeffrey. We love you. And those little things would have, not so little, would have gone such a long way. And I think it's fine for parents to say to children, I'm sad or I'm having a hard time right now. None of that was ever communicated. And I think just to be able to have that conversation and to say that this is a hard time for mommy and daddy, and to be aware that siblings too, as my brother, who you had said, you know, how is it possible that he doesn't have those memories, right? For him to have had that conversation would have helped so greatly. And so I think that would be an advice that I would give, and something in my own family that I tried to communicate to my children.
So family secrets are typically actually not a secret, and often the children or the people in the family that you want to quote-unquote protect by keeping the secret are in fact not protected at all.
Oh, that's, You say that so well, absolutely. And we think we're protecting a child by not saying something or whispering or not talking about something at all. But children are smart, very intuitive, and they know.
They know and they feel, which is another thing that, you know, more and more, you know, in today's world, we recognize that children have their whole breadth of experiences and ways that they take in information and experiences, which was not quite the case as you were coming up. You know, I mean, as you know, children were to be seen and not heard and to do what they were told, period.
Exactly. And also, when I would feel a certain way, my mother would say, don't feel that way.
Yeah.
Or you shouldn't feel that way.
Which is, well, again, a whole other conversation, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Dr. Jaffe, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you, albeit about challenging experiences, but experiences that so many people have, and now they have a place to turn to get some more information. You are also a Psychology Today columnist. How does one access, get information about your book and about your column?
Well, they can go onto my website, and I'll spell it. It's BarbaraAnnJaffe.com, BarbaraAnnJaffe.com. And on the website, they can learn more about me, about my book, about my Psychology Today articles, my Inner Self articles. I also have a blog. They can sign up for my newsletter. They can also purchase the book through the different Amazon and Barnes & Noble or wherever, and certainly learn more about a replacement child and many issues that we all deal with.
Thank you very much. You certainly are very busy. I heard you say you're retired, but it doesn't sound like you are retired at all. Thank you so much, not only for a brilliantly, beautifully written book, but also for the time that you've shared with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org, mindtalk.org. And there is a free Mind Talk app that you can download from Google Play or iTunes. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.